You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this inaugural day with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. And we're here today not to talk about all the movies ever featuring stories about presidents, which, you know, now that I think about it, there's like a lot of them.
There are.
There's a huge... Well, I mean, if you count things like... The giant ants are attacking Los Angeles, and now a word from the president, you know. Beyond that, I mean, there's, you know, one of the things that I noticed was that when a Democrat is in office, they tend to make movies about the president as a kind of an action hero, superhero. So, like, what's the one with Harrison Ford?
Air Force One.
Air Force One, you know, yes. Stuff like that. And Independence Day, of course, Independence Day, probably the greatest, I think. It's up there somewhere with Citizen Kane, I think. But at any rate, we'll pass over that because we're here to actually talk about. Go ahead and tell them.
We're here to talk about the really important thing that happened today, which is that this is the day that I released my best films of 2016 list. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. I mean, let's keep some perspective. Something else happened today. I can't remember what. So let's talk about your best films list here.
Yeah. So. I have been for the last month or so frantically scrambling to catch up on all of the films that that I had missed out on. And this year, I have to say, on the one hand, it was particularly hard to put together my list. And what I do is I always put together a top 30. There's the official top 10, which is ranked from 1 to 10.
Okay.
1 being the highest.
So I figured.
Then there is the runners up, which are 10 more films that are unranked. Okay. And then there are the 10 honorable mentions. And this year I had a harder time on the one hand filling up this rank of 30 films because Hollywood just really had a not great year. So the movies that I saw by default, the movies that I saw just because my job and life impelled me to go to the theaters and not the movies that I had to seek out. They just weren't great, you know. On the other hand, once I started digging,
except for Independence Day Resurgence, but that goes without saying. So,
the film that, of course, made the most money, I think, the new Star Wars movie, Rogue One. I wasn't crazy about it, so that, you know, I was behind the eight ball there.
Yeah,
and Captain America: Civil War. Yeah, it had a great airport scene. And did you want to talk about superhero movies? Because there's also Batman versus Superman. I know how much you love that subject. So Hollywood didn't have a great year in terms of the big blockbusters and the movies that I saw by default. But once I started digging and going a little bit off the beaten path and catching up on films over the last month or two, I discovered an overwhelming plethora, an abundance, an embarrassment of riches of great films. In fact, in the end, I put together a list of 30 films without dipping down out of my A-list films into the B-pluses, which this is the first year I've ever done that.
Well, I applaud you then. I mean, yeah. That's a... Okay. Now, I'm ready now. Hit me. This is going to be good then. I figured, you know, 2016... Everything about it sucked, so I figured, you know, this was also going to be like the least sucky films of 2016. But
No. There are some great ones. And I'm going to go thematically rather than in order. But okay. We're going to wind up with my number one film of the year, which is just a really lovely film that I'm very much looking forward to sharing with you.
All right. I'm looking forward to it.
So let's talk first of all about a topic near and dear to my heart, family films. 2016 was a great year for family films, and some very good family films like Pixar's Finding Dory and Kubo and the Two Strings and Steven Spielberg's The BFG, which are in the B plus range, didn't even make my top 30.
Oh,
yeah. Ones that did, that are in that A-minus range, include a pair of Disney remakes, The Jungle Book, Jon Favreau's wonderful, rollicking family adventure movie. It's a real throwback to a kind of movie that they just don't make anymore, and a lot of fun. I've seen it at least three times.
Okay.
And even better, I like, that was on my honorable mentions. On my runners-up, I included Pete's Dragon from David Lowery, the other Disney remake, which in some ways I liked even better than Jungle Book. But there are three family films that stand head and shoulders above all the rest that are in my top 10.
Okay.
So starting with number 10, a film that we've talked about in the past, Queen of Katwe. This is Mira Nair's fact-based Disney movie about a Ugandan female Christian chess champion. Mm-hmm. Yes, Disney made a movie about a Ugandan female Christian chess champion. And I am watching it right now with my family. We watched the first half of it last night. And so we're going to finish it up. Probably not tonight, but hopefully tomorrow. Okay. Stars David Oyelowo, who is a Christian. He's Martin Luther King Jr. from Selma. And Lupita Nyong'o from 12 Years a Slave. And they're fantastic. And Mira Nair, who directed it, has a house in Uganda. And she really understands the local culture. And it's just one. Everyone who sees Queen of Katwe tells me that they love it. Very few people have seen it. So that's my number 10 film.
Okay.
Next, at number 7, film that we haven't talked about yet, April and the Extraordinary World. This is also available for purchase on Amazon. Forget Zootopia. April and the Extraordinary World is a wild French language animated film that is set in an alternate European history. It's a little steampunk. It's a little political fiction. It's got Jules Verne technology. It's got talking animals.
Oh, and
yeah. It's just really, really wonderful.
How fun.
It is.
Okay. I'd never even heard of it. By the way, speaking of just slight diversion, nothing to do with the top 10 list, but have you ever seen A Town Called Panic?
Yes. Yes.
That is the craziest thing I have ever seen.
Oh, it's just, it's really lovely. And there's
so fun.
I think I know that they made one film, and I think that they've made another one that I haven't seen yet. But the original shorts, the first short cake is just a thing of such wonderful anarchic energy. It's completely insane. You just can't explain it.
Oh, it's
What's great?
My son introduced me to it. It's French language for those who have not seen it. It's French language film, subtitled, and it's basically this crazy movie about using these sort of plastic toy action figures that they just turned into characters in this movie. So there's a cowboy, an Indian, and a horse, and they all live together and in this crazy town where, believe me, it's just, you've never seen anything like it.
It's wonderful, but what's great about April and the Extraordinary World is that it has a similar kind of freewheeling anarchic energy, but it weds it in a very disciplined way to a rigorously thought out alternate world that pinpoints the exact moment when history diverges from the real world and why and how. Mm-hmm. This is a world in which, for various reasons, the Industrial Revolution did not proceed the way that it did in our world. Electricity was never discovered. Science has been artificially retarded. There's no internal combustion engine. Everything relies much more on steam power and so forth. Mm. And then it just proceeds to follow this logically through this crazy narrative, which is just – it's propulsive and it's fantastic. April and the Extraordinary World. That is my favorite family – number 7 on my list of top 10. It's my favorite family film of the year unless you count in number 4 in theaters this weekend, The Red Turtle. The Red Turtle from Oscar-winning Dutch animator Michael Dudok de Wit. He is the director of a little short from 2000 Oscar winner that you might possibly have seen, having the son that you do, the animation fan, father and daughter. The dad goes off on a boat and leaves the little girl behind.
Okay.
So The Red Turtle, this is a rare feature-length animated film that captures and channels the energy of the best animated shorts and sustains it out over the course of 80 minutes. It's the story of a guy who's shipwrecked on a desert island, and then there's this giant turtle, and later on there's a woman, and I'm not going to go into the details, but it tells the whole story without any dialogue. It's just got this kind of mythic fable-like power that's just really, really wonderful. The Red Turtle in theaters this weekend, my number 4 film of 2016.
Extremely cool. Looking forward to hearing about more. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gridonis talking about the top 10 films of 2016. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gridonis talking about the 10 best films of 2016. If you want to join us, you can give us a call at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And so, what's next?
So we talked about family films in the first segment. 2016 was a great year for family films. It was also, as we've been talking in our last couple of shows, a great year for films with religious themes. And in fact, one of our family films, Queen of Katwe, is kind of straddles both of these categories. There were a lot of films with Jesus in them, including one that I wasn't quite able to get into my list, the Coen brothers' Hail Caesar, and one that I actually did, The Young Messiah. There was Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge, starring Andrew Garfield as a devoutly Christian World War II vet, Desmond Doss, who refused to carry a gun. There was Birth of a Nation, Nate Parker's controversial account of the Nat Turner slave revolt. But the film this year that offered the most extraordinary treatment of religious themes, I think, was my number 3 film of 2016, Martin Scorsese's Silence, which also stars Andrew Garfield as another devout character, Jesuit missionary who goes to 17th century Japan. This is a film that is as masterful and as difficult as its source material, the masterpiece by Japanese Catholic novelist Shizaku Endo. Absolutely flopped at the box office this past weekend. Very difficult film, but I think that Catholics and other Christians should definitely go and see it.
Okay. All right. Cool.
As long as we're talking about religious themes, we should mention that a genre that often takes religious themes more seriously than other genres is horror. And this year there were a number of films worth mentioning in this category. There was The Conjuring 2 with its devoutly Catholic protagonists, husband and wife, demon hunting team. There was a very interesting and well-done Persian language film called Under the Shadow, set in Tehran in the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War, in which a woman and her daughter are haunted by a jinn. The year's best religious-themed horror film, number 8 on my list of the top 10 films of 2016, an extraordinary film, but definitely not for all tastes, is The Witch from Robert Eggers. The Witch is rooted historically and theologically in the world of 17th century Puritanism. The film is subtitled A New England Folk Tale, and it is based very closely on New England legends and stories and documents. The language is very archaic and really historically rooted in this time period in a way that helps to take the viewer out of the present and really enter into this world. It's a very disturbing film, but it's one with great empathy for the Puritans, who are of course among the most caricatured of historical figures, and it offers a critique of what is wrong with their version of Calvinism, and especially in one of the more extreme forms as we see in the film, without in any way offering sympathy for the devil or for his minions. So The Witch, really, really great film. Very difficult.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool. What's next?
So let's talk about Hollywood Spectacle. Like I said, not a great year for this particular category. If you were a fan of Rogue One, of course, there was that. For me, I think my favorite Hollywood blockbuster of 2016 was, and this doesn't quite make my top 10 list, but it was my favorite, Scott Derrickson's Doctor Strange, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. Mm-hmm. Marvel movie, your favorite subject, I know.
It was a fun movie, I got to say.
Yes, yes. And really an excellent film in so many ways. It was a vanishingly rare superhero movie that doesn't look like every other superhero movie or any action movie that I've ever seen. It's a movie that cleverly avoids and even inverts what nearly all films in this genre do, which is come down to epic urban destruction and, you know, leveling buildings and skyscrapers and laying waste to cities, because, you know, when you have superpowered characters and, you know, this is how you can, it's got to be a big finish.
That's right. But, like the Avengers.
Like the Avengers. Yes. Right. Yes.
Although I got to say that one of the things that I appreciated about the Avengers, especially the follow-ups after the Avengers, was like they don't get to just walk away from destroying New York and everybody's grateful. They're like, hey, you wrecked our city. You know?
Yes, yes. Well, and one thing I have to say for Captain America: Civil War is that it begins with the heroes taking responsibility for their urban destruction, and it ends with a much smaller action set piece. It's really just a fist fight among two or three of the heroes.
Right.
But Doctor Strange finds a way to subvert this whole trend. It's also a redemption story, the best redemption story in the genre since Tony Stark's original in the original Iron Man of 2008. Mm-hmm. It's a movie that Scott Derrickson, being a Christian, he brings certain things to it. And it's a film that challenges the protagonist's materialistic nihilism, as well as his egocentrism. You know, there is no such thing as spirit. We are made of matter and nothing else. Okay. Not so much.
Sharp learning curve ahead, Dr. Yes. Strange.
Yes. So I saw Dr. Strange twice in theaters. I took my whole family to see it in 3D. I was sure it would wind up on my top 10 list, but 10 other films made a better case. And one of them, my favorite Hollywood spectacle of the year, not quite a blockbuster, but a fantastic film that I know you're a big fan of, is Denis Villeneuve's Arrival.
Yeah. Yes, big fan of Arrival.
Yeah.
And yet, in many ways, very it feels very much like a small indie film.
Uh-huh.
It has that sort of quiet nature to it, you know, which we Americans don't tend to associate with a science fiction movie. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, not at all. Not at all. I've been talking all the time. We finally got to a movie that you've seen. You might want to have something to say about it. It's your show.
Okay. Well, go ahead. I want to hear what you've got to say.
Well, it's a film that raises all kinds of interesting ideas, that explores free will and determinism, that explores the implications of language for thought and consciousness. And it's ultimately, of course, in a way that I don't want to talk about too overtly because I don't want to spoil it for anyone who's listening who hasn't seen it. Right. But it's a life-affirming film.
It certainly is. And yeah.
Go ahead.
Keep going.
Well, so it's a life-affirming film, and it's a film that affirms the value even of a life that is tragically cut short and that is circumscribed by suffering and by grief. This is, I think, a real rebuke to our euthanasia society and Pope Francis has called our throwaway society.
Yeah.
You know, you do the genetic test and you see that your baby has Down syndrome and, you know, that's it. You know, flush the kid.
I'd get a new one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's a film that says, even if, you know, this life is going to be cut short and it's going, you know, it's going to end prematurely and there's going to be suffering and grief, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have value and that we don't still embrace it. And I think that's very powerful.
Yeah, I thought so too. I thought it was, in many ways, it was the pro-life movie of the year. And as a, you know, English major, I was very interested in the movie is really the center of it in many ways, is this discussion of the idea of what's going on with language, what's happening in the act of translation. The guy that wrote it lives actually not very far from me.
Right.
He lives over in Bellevue across the lake from me. And he's a tech writer for Microsoft. The guy's named Ted Chiang. And his fiction is all short stories. And he's only written 15 short stories since 1990. So he's somebody that ruminates for a long time and then comes out with a story and it wins 50 million awards because it's always some work of colossal genius. And that was the case here. And what got him thinking about Arrival was exactly the work that he does as a technical writer, translating ideas that nobody can understand into ideas that anybody can understand. Which is kind of a tech writer's job.
Sure. You
know, most of us don't belong to the high priesthood of code monkeys at Microsoft. And so somebody has to do the work of making this inaccessible stuff accessible to the rest of us. And it's only, you know, amplified. The problem is only amplified when you're talking about an alien race, something whose biology is completely foreign to ours, the workings of its mind are completely different from ours. How would you communicate in that case? And that was what made that film so fascinating to me, was that struggle. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are talking with Deacon Steve Gordonis about the top 10 films of 2016, and we'll be back right after this. All righty. break. Is Suzanne listening to this, or is she still?
Yeah, surely.
Oh, she's not with the ladies. Okay.
No.
Okay. Yeah, so I went to Mass today. That was the way I observed my civic duties today. I figured the best thing I can do is go pray for our country. So that's what I did. And I'm going to write something for, I'll write for the Catholic Weekly next week. I'll do a piece on our duty as Christian citizens. Look at Romans 13. Combination typing and Morse code.
Yeah, I've got my, well, I'm trying to eat my soup at the same time. so I've got my keyboard in a funny position.
Okay. That sounds great right up close to a microphone.
All right, I'll mute it.
No, that's fine. Not a problem. It just amuses me.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we are going down the list of the top 10 films of 2016. Just to be clear, number one is the best one. So, but we haven't got there yet because, you know, that will be, all will be revealed.
Yes.
So, what's next? What's next?
So 2016 was also a remarkable year for films dealing with race and race relations. Ava DuVernay's The 13th made a big splash when it opened at the New York Film Festival. It's a documentary that deals with mass incarceration and slave labor in America and how the prison system in America profits from prisoners and in particular how that relates to policing and law enforcement and so forth.
Right.
It's a very good documentary, but it did not push into my top 30.
Okay.
But a number of other documentaries and at least one film that's not a documentary did. Let's talk about the non-documentary for a second. I think I've mentioned before. The drama Loving from Jeff Nichols. This is the fact-based film about the couple behind the Supreme Court case, Loving versus Virginia, that legalized interracial marriage. And
that case was in – when that was 1965?
It was in the 1960s. I don't know if it was 65.
Okay.
Let's see. Loving versus Virginia it was actually 1967, if you can believe that.
Astonishing.
Isn't it?
It's mind-boggling to me that these things happened, you know, within living memory, for me at any rate. I saw something the other day that just took my breath away. Things that you just never thought about. Until the early 1960s, until the early 1960s, Aborigines in Australia were classified as fauna.
Yes.
It's mind-boggling to me that that can be true, that they were classified as animal wildlife in Australia until the early 1960s.
Unbelievable. Yes. And Loving, to its credit, does a good job of evoking the cultural world in which this situation existed. I might have liked to see a little more ambiguity in the depiction of some of the white Virginians. The movie does, I think, perhaps suggest a little bit too much. You know, pretty much all the white Virginians are racist and against the Lovings, with a possible exception of their lawyer. But what I appreciate it is that, and this is the director of Midnight Special and Mud, and he has a very slow, quiet style, and he approaches the story less as a legal drama than he does as a portrait of this couple and of the world in which they live. And the court case is really kind of a small part of the story, because these are just two people living their lives, and they have other things to think about besides the court case.
Mm-hmm.
It's a powerful film. Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga play the couple, and so really, really good. Loving.
Okay.
There are also a couple of documentaries that are really worth mentioning besides The 13th. One of them is "I Am Not Your Negro" by Raoul Peck. This is a documentary about American race relations that was inspired by a project that was begun by James Baldwin. It was originally called Remember This House. And what he wanted to do was to explore race relations in America through the lives of three murdered civil rights leaders, all of whom he knew, who he's friends with.
Okay.
Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr.
Okay.
And so obviously, he died before he could finish what he was doing, but he left behind, 30 or 40 pages worth of notes. And so the documentary uses that to explore these men's lives and a little bit of quotations from Baldwin, read by Samuel L. Jackson. And it uses the power of cinema much more effectively than The 13th did, which is why I thought it was a much better film.
Okay.
But the year's best look at racial issues from a documentary perspective is the, believe it or not, almost 8-hour documentary O.J. Made in America from Ezra Edelman. And you might think that you know everything that you needed to know about O.J. Simpson and the trial and all of that stuff. But believe me, Ezra Edelman has done an astounding job of using O.J. Simpson as a lens with which to explore a much broader scope of issues relating to American culture, to race relations, to policing, to sports culture. It's just a staggeringly well-done film. It is 8 of the best hours that you will spend watching anything. He explores why it was that white Americans and black Americans had such very different reactions to the O.J. trial and to the question of his guilt and innocence. And, this was something that for a lot of white people at the time, I just found that absurd. I found it ridiculous. I didn't understand how – and it's not going to change your mind about his guilt or innocence.
Right.
Really makes a very compelling case that there's just no question of his guilt.
The guy's guilty, right? Yeah, of course.
He's guilty of sin.
Of course.
But you will understand the reactions to the case much better, and you will understand another thing that really comes across very well is just the power of OJ's charisma. how he has this kind of perception altering aura around him. Mm-hmm. And it just, he had the ability to make you want to be on his side. Mm-hmm. That's just really, really amazing. And then of course it documents his downfall and what happened afterwards and how it is that he's in jail now and so forth. OJ Made in America. I really can't recommend this documentary enough. It's that good and that far reaching in its the one thing that it doesn't do, and I thought that this was very interesting. This is a point that I owe to A.O. Scott. A.O. Scott, in his excellent review of O.J. Made in America, points out that the movie explores many aspects of this story from the perspective of seeing things as a case in point or a symbol of larger issues in American culture. Certainly, O.J. is explored from many aspects as a symbol for other things in American culture. Nicole Brown Simpson is only seen in the story as an individual victim. And what Scott points out is that there was a whole issue here of misogyny in American sports culture. Mm-hmm. And how domestic violence and so forth, right, that could have been explored from a cultural perspective that just isn't. And that is, that's something that really could have been looked at. But at the same time, the film sees so much so clearly. It's really very illuminating and just extremely well done cinema. Just really great.
Okay, very good. Yeah, well, especially after this year, I mean, this has been an eye-opening year for...
Yes!
I think a lot of us, for a lot of us white conservatives, it's been a shocking, eye-opening year. And so I think it's important to have that there, to remind us that this didn't just begin. All those voices have been saying, listen to us. There really is a problem. They all kind of came into focus this year, at least for me. But yeah, anyway, go ahead.
So what else is left? I have at least three other films in my top 10 that we need to talk about. And one of them is number 6, okay. Love and Friendship, from Whit Stillman. This is Whit Stillman's delicious adaptation of a very unknown and unfinished work by Jane Austen, posthumously published novel, starring Kate Beckinsale. And the union of Whit Stillman and Jane Austen is a thing of beauty. He's been called the Jane Austen of indie cinema, and in Metropolitan, he references Jane Austen and uses her kind of as a lens for his critique of culture, and bringing his hyper literate, extremely witty language to something that was actually written by Austen is just really, really wonderful.
All right,
And Friendship.
Love and Friendship. I'm looking forward to that, too. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We're talking about the top 10 films of 2016. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis talking about the best films of 2016. And if you want to join us, you're welcome to do so. You can give us a call at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. We actually had a call yesterday. I was it's such a rare event. On the show, so that was exciting, but anyway, we continue. We're counting down. We're almost out of best films. What's
yes?
What's next?
I think. Well, you know, there are so many films in my honorable mention and runners up lists that we haven't gotten to, and I encourage people to go to decentfilms.com and link over to the National Catholic Register and read the full list. But there are two films left, my number two and number one films, and I especially want to focus on number one. Number two is a really extraordinary film. It's another documentary by a woman named Kirsten Johnson, who is a cinematographer, and the film is called Camera Person. Okay. And it's a film not like anything I've ever seen before. You could call it a kind of a cinematic scrapbook. She calls it a memoir. It's made entirely of shots from various documentary projects that she's worked on in the past. That did not get used in those films. So that these are some deleted scenes. And she stitches them together in a way that may seem random at first, but there is definitely a pattern to it. And as you watch the film, it becomes a kind of filmmaker's examination of conscience. And and even at times, a confessional with respect to the filmmakers, and especially the documentary filmmakers' relationship with their subject and their responsibility to their subject. You know, documentarians are often thought of as just the fact. They're just kind of neutrally shooting what happens without being involved. But you can't insert yourself into a situation without altering that situation. And how you do that and when you intervene and how you intervene, these are all important questions, and they all have moral implications, and that is really the subject of this very interesting and powerful film.
Interesting. Yeah, well, and it's one of those mysterious principles of physics, even, that to observe is to change.
Absolutely.
And I have a friend who, he was just a mortal enemy of the films of the Lord of the Rings.
Uh-huh.
And he remarked to me, and I'm sure he's quoting somebody, but I don't know where it comes from. But his remark was, "There is death in the camera." and I could see what he was getting at. There is a weird way in which the very presence of a camera, especially in documentary films, alters things. People don't behave like they would normally do when there's a camera pointed at them.
Sure.
That's interesting. So we continue.
Yes. I could spend the rest of the show just talking about Camera Person, and I would love to do that. But the film that I really, really want to encourage everyone to see, we're going to probably wind up talking about it more next time, is my favorite film of 2016 for the second year in a row. My number one film is a quiet and winning love story that is named for an urban area, more or less, in my backyard. Last year, it was John Crowley's Brooklyn, which is just a wonderful, wonderful story that I encourage everyone listening to see if you haven't seen it.
I did. It was a lovely film.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I really like Brooklyn. I took my wife. It's a great date movie, fellas. If you're looking for some way to get your girl to just fall in love with you all over again, take her to see Brooklyn or rent it now. But
yes. Yeah. And a film that about which many similar things could be said this year is Jim Jarmusch's Patterson. Patterson, named for Patterson, New Jersey, not far from where I live and where I went to school for 3 years. And it stars Adam Driver as a bus driver in Patterson, whose name is also Patterson. and who has an affinity for poetry. He likes to read it. He likes to write it. And he's married to a woman named Laura, who is played by the wonderful, wonderful Golshifteh Farahani. And they have what might be, Jeffrey Overstreet said, that he thought that they might be his all-time favorite screen couple ever. And that might be true for me too. They have yes, they just have this, we follow them over the course of a week, and in keeping with the poetic theme, each day plays out with a certain structure, and with repetitions, within which there is room for inspiration and creativity, like the structure of a sonnet. And we watch how Patterson goes through his very kind of habitual routine lifestyle. He's very much a creature of habit, which you would have to be to, you know, get up every morning and, you know, and drive a bus for a living. You're driving the same bus over the same route. You pick up different people and different things strike you. And all of this bubbles up to him in, as he kind of zones out into poetry. His wife is completely different. She's very spontaneous. She's bristling with creativity. Every day she has a different dream for what she wants to do with her life. They're very different, but they each adore each other. They each enjoy each other's gifts. And they just, their relationship is just a fantastic thing. And it's a privilege to spend this week with them.
Oh, well, that does sound good. I, you know, the, when I think of married couples, I mean, really ordinary married couples in films that I like, what I often come back to is Fargo. And Frances McDormand's character in Fargo and her husband, who are just regular people. I mean, there's nothing dramatic about them. And you would think that a the characters like that would somehow be boring, but they're not, especially in the whirlwind of chaos that happens in the rest of that film.
Right.
You're just so relieved to know these people.
But here's the thing. Patterson, like Brooklyn last year, is a film that allows you to enjoy a relationship like that without all of the
people being fed into wood.
Exactly. You know, both Jim Jarmusch and Adam Driver have both called Patterson an antidote to heavy action, heavy drama, heavy crisis. And you know, heavy crisis films can be valuable and important. And I always have some in my top films list.
Right.
But I also value these films that are the antidote to all of that.
Okay.
Patterson is about the interplay of the prose of ordinary life and the poetry of reflection and aesthetic enjoyment. It brings to mind a phrase from Thomas Howard's wonderful Chance or the Dance, the title of the last chapter, Bravo the Humdrum. You know, it's not about how Patterson's poetry is an escape from the drudgery of driving a bus. And it's not about, you know, how this silly bus driver has these, you know, fantasies of being a poet when he's not a towering literary genius who, you know, is slumming as a bus driver. But at the same token, he's not a fool who aspires to something unattainable. It's really a very beautiful balance there.
Oh, wow. Okay. You know, what's great about these conversations particularly is at least half the films that you mentioned today, I literally have never even heard of. I'd never heard of Patterson before.
Expanding wider next week.
Okay. Yeah. And that's see, this is why I love having you on the show. Is because I get these heads up on films that for whatever reason I just haven't crossed my paths yet, and so that just tickles me. Yeah, the you know, one of the things that I think is missing in American life are characters who are allowed to like poetry. Poetry used to be just the normal thing that everybody, this is how whole cultures were centered around poets. So you would have people who would carry on conversations of, you know, in ancient Greece, their poetry informed their conversations the way that our film references do.
Right, exactly.
In our conversations today. And America, there's something, somehow or other, poetry has become this thing that only sort of, you know, buttercup twirling elitists are allowed to like now, you know. And I love that there's a character who is permitted to enjoy poetry and to like writing it as well as reading it in a film. That makes my heart happy as a lit major.
And he has this job that's, you know, it's not a sexy job. It's not, you know, even necessarily a very interesting job, but it doesn't, the movie doesn't condescend to that. You know, there's honor in what he does. And next week, I want to talk more about what makes Patterson such a special character. I want to talk about Patterson as a hero of masculine virtue.
All right. Well, then we will do that next week on Connecting the Dots. You've been listening to Deacon Stephen Gerdanis and me, Mark Shea, your host, here on Connecting the Dots on Breadbox Media. Our producer today was Mr. Danny Head. And we will be back on Monday with the creator of Eye of the Tiber. All of you Catholics out there who appreciate good satire will have to listen in. Until next Monday, have a wonderful weekend, and thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.